This episode of The Trail Went Cold is brought to you by Zola. Zola is reinventing the wedding registry and planning process to make the happiest moment in couples' lives even happier. To sign up with Zola and receive a $50 credit towards your registry, visit zola.com/cold. That's zola.com/cold. This episode is also brought to you by Aptive. Aptive produces audio-based workouts created by certified personal trainers available through a mobile app. New members get 50% off an annual membership, so please visit aptive.com/cold. That's aaptive.com/cold. Thank you, and enjoy the show. January 12th, 1984. Atlantic City, New Jersey. 7-year-old Gary Grant Jr., the son of a local police detective, leaves his home after telling his mother he is meeting someone for an appointment. 2 days later, Gary's body is discovered in a vacant lot after he has been bludgeoned to death with a pipe. A 12-year-old friend of Gary's named Carl Boo Mason soon confesses to the murder and is charged with the crime, but since Boo has a mental disability and a low IQ, his confession is thrown out and the charges are dropped. Over the next 3 decades, Gary's father would be taunted by cryptic graffiti and the recording of an anonymous 911 caller confessing to the crime, but the identity of Gary's killer remains unknown. After that, the trail went cold.
Mason Fire.
Yes. Is it possible for me to collect a reward on my own self for the murder of Gary Grant?
Is it for you to collect a reward on yourself?
Uh-huh.
If you have information, what are you saying? I don't know what you mean. Like, do you know who did it or something like that you mean?
No, how's if I did it myself and I want to collect the whole reward?
If you did it?
Yeah.
Well, suppose I hook you into the Detective Bureau.
No, it's okay.
I mean,
make sure they know that's not a crank call. You'll never be able to catch him.
You know what?
You'll never be able to catch him.
Hello everyone, and welcome to the latest episode of The Trail Went Cold. I'm your host Robin Warder, and today we will be covering a pretty disturbing case which was featured on Unsolved Mysteries, the 1984 murder of 7-year-old Gary Grant Jr. Stories in which children are harmed are pretty tough going, which is why I only feature them on this podcast intermittently. But even though this case just passed its 34th anniversary a few days before this episode's release, I think it still might be solvable. That sound clip you just heard was a recording of a 911 call from 1986 in which an anonymous male caller confessed to Gary's murder, and yes, he actually asked if it was possible to collect a reward on himself for the crime. The most unbelievable thing is that Gary's father, a retired police detective, did not actually hear this recording until he discovered an audio tape of the call nearly 30 years later, so I can only imagine how he felt when he heard it. This recording was publicly released only a few months before The Trail Went Cold launched, and I've been wanting to cover this case for a long time, as it contains a number of surprising twists and turns. However, before we get started, just a quick reminder that The Trail Went Cold is a weekly podcast which is currently available for download on several platforms, including iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play Music. So if you like this podcast, be sure to subscribe to it, and please leave us a rating or review to help spread the word. The Trail Went Cold also has its own PayPal account and a donate button on the website. If there's anyone out there who wants to make a donation, we would greatly appreciate it, and we'll be sure to give you a shout-out on a future episode. So with all that out of the way, let us now explore the unsolved murder of Gary Grant Jr.
Thank you.
Our story begins in Atlantic City, New Jersey in 1984. Our central figure is 7-year-old Gary Grant Jr., who lives with his mother, May Grant, and his two older sisters. Gary's father, Gary Grant Sr., is a detective with the Atlantic City Police Department, and at this time, he and May have been separated for nearly a year. On Thursday, January 12th, Gary was home from school because there was a teacher's conference. That morning, he told his mother that he had a quote-unquote appointment with someone at around 2:30 p.m., but when May asked him who it was with, Gary replied that it was a secret. May figured he was probably just meeting up with another kid or something and didn't think anything of it. At around noon, Gary left their house to go outside and play and told his mother he would be back by 4 o'clock. Well, Gary did not return by then, and by the time nightfall hit, he had still not returned home for dinner, so his mother started searching the neighborhood for him. She couldn't find any sign of Gary and grew very concerned, so she decided to call Gary Grant Sr. to inform him that Gary was missing. Since Gary Sr.'s shift with the Atlantic City Police Department started at midnight, he called in sick so he could spend the night looking for his son, but he also had no luck finding him. By the following morning, a missing persons report was filed with the police, who launched an extensive search for Gary. Due to departmental regulations, Gary Sr. could not officially participate in the actual police investigation for his own son, but he would spend every waking moment of the next day and a half conducting his own personal searches for Gary. It would not be until the afternoon of January 14th, 2 days after Gary went missing, when there was a horrifying discovery. At around 3:30 p.m., Gary's body was found in a vacant, weed-filled lot next to a warehouse located only 2 blocks from his home. He had been bludgeoned to death after someone struck him across the head multiple times, and the murder weapon, a short length of heavy pipe, was found nearby. Gary's body had also been covered by a rug, which might explain why his body wasn't discovered for 2 days. The Atlantic City PD imposed a radio silence until Gary's family could be notified, but in a cruel twist of fate, Gary Sr. just happened to drive by his son's murder scene shortly after the police cordoned it off, and was informed of the tragic news right after he stopped. Anyway, the investigation would now focus on the quote-unquote appointment Gary told his mother he was having at 2:30 on the afternoon he left the house, as it seemed like this might have a connection to his murder. Police immediately canvassed the neighborhood for information and interviewed many people, and multiple eyewitnesses would remember seeing Gary with a local 12-year-old on the day he went missing. The individual in question was Carl Mason, who went by the nickname Boo, because he was described as being easily frightened and practically afraid of his own shadow. As a result of a mental disability, Boo only had an IQ of 65. He was raised by his grandmother, who was also described as having limited education and limited intelligence. Boo's father lived in Philadelphia, and while Boo's mother also lived with him, she was incapable of raising a child by herself, which is why Boo's grandmother was considered his legal guardian. Boo also had an older brother who had been arrested on robbery charges just a few days before Gary's murder. Boo was only about 4 feet tall and weighed only 60 pounds, so even though he was 5 years older than Gary, Gary was actually taller and weighed 20 pounds more than him. Even though May Grant would state that she told Gary he was not allowed to hang out with Boo, they still remained friends and would often play together. When police went to question Boo, he claimed that the last time he saw Gary was on Wednesday, January 11th. According to Boo, he and Gary had planned to meet 2 sister friends of theirs at their house on the afternoon he went missing, but Gary never showed up. Well, these 2 sisters would contradict Boo's claim by telling police that both he and Gary had shown up at their house together that day. Even though Boo seemed like a harmless character on the surface and an unlikely murder suspect, these discrepancies were enough to compel police to bring Boo down to the station for further questioning, which began sometime after midnight on January 15th. Even though Boo was accompanied by his grandmother, he did not have an attorney present, and his grandmother would not be in the room during the first few hours he was questioned. According to police, Boo just could not keep his story straight when asked to account for his whereabouts on the afternoon Gary went missing, but things eventually reached the point where Boo admitted being with Gary that day, and even shared a story about how Gary had been running before falling and hitting his head. But after being interrogated for over 2 hours, Boo finally told detectives that he hit Gary in the head with a pipe. It was here that they read Boo his Miranda rights and told him he was entitled to an attorney, but Boo and his grandmother would both sign a statement to waive those rights. Upon further interrogation, Boo's story continued to change. At one point, he was given a polygraph test, but the results were inconclusive. However, Boo did eventually provide a full account of the crime, claiming that he hit Gary with a pipe after the two of them had gotten into a fight, and Gary threw a rock at him. One specific detail which stood out to police was when Boo mentioned choking Gary, as no one knew this detail until it was corroborated by Gary's autopsy. At around 8 a.m. that morning, police typed up a confession to the crime and convinced both Boo and his grandmother to sign it. The statement read, "He threw a rock at me and I hit him with the thing, because I grabbed him by the neck. A pipe. Two or three times. He fell. I took a rug and put it on top of him." Boo was then formally charged with the murder of Gary Grant Jr. and sent to a juvenile detention center. Well, given that Boo was a 12-year-old with a mental disability and an IQ of 65, there was a lot of debate about the veracity of a confession which had been obtained by interrogating him overnight for nearly 8 hours. Boo would maintain his innocence, claiming that he had nothing to do with Gary's murder and only confessed to the crime because he was exhausted, and the police had told him he would be allowed to go home and sleep as long as he signed their statement. Boo's grandmother would claim that she never actually saw him flat out confess to the crime, and that the exchanges between Boo and the detectives were more like them saying, "You did it, didn't you, Carl?" and Boo replying, "If you say I did, but I didn't." 3 days after he was charged, Boo wound up receiving a second polygraph test. Both of the tests indicated that Boo was being truthful when he said he did not kill Gary, but there did appear to be signs of deception whenever he was asked if he was at the scene and witnessed Gary being killed. The investigation was unable to uncover any other hard evidence which linked Boo to the crime, as his fingerprints were not on the pipe. While two spots of blood were found on Boo's clothing, they were so small that it was impossible to tell if the blood belonged to Gary, and his defense attorney stated that the spots could have been there for months. So it seemed like the entire crux of the police's case would be Boo's confession. 1 month after the arrest, a hearing was held in juvenile court to determine if the confession would be admissible when Boo went to trial. A superior court judge ruled to have the confession thrown out, stating that it had been illegally obtained and, quote, "had trampled on the constitutional rights of this juvenile," end quote. The judge also had major issues with the fact that Boo's Miranda rights were not read to him until 3:15 a.m. after he had already been interrogated for over 2 hours, and made his first mention of hitting Gary with the pipe. He stated that discussing Miranda rights with Boo and his grandmother under those circumstances would, quote, "be of as little utility as discussing the recent developments in nuclear physics with them," end quote. With no other evidence to implicate him, the prosecutor's office had no choice but to eventually drop the murder charges against Boo. Anyway, this caused the investigation to come to a complete standstill for nearly 2 years. However, during the early morning hours of January 4th, 1986, an Atlantic City police officer would discover some cryptic graffiti painted on the side of his patrol car. It read, "Gary Grant's dead. I am living. Another will die on 1/12/86 if all goes right." Well, of course, January 12th, 1986 just happened to be the official 2-year anniversary of Gary's murder. Gary Grant Sr. was called in to look at the graffiti, and he believed that it was written by an adult, not just some simple childish prank. Well, January 12th came and went, and nothing happened, but there would be another odd development a few weeks later, when a second cryptic message was found scrawled on an Atlantic City sidewalk. It read, "Gary Grant lives. I still killed him. Son of a pig officer. Payback is an MF." And I'm sure I don't have to tell you what the initials MF stand for. Well, the nature of this message caused many people to speculate that Gary's murder might have been committed by someone who wanted revenge on his father. Given that Gary Sr. had worked as a police detective for over a decade at this point, was his son killed over an arrest he had made in the past? Well, Gary Sr. always maintained that even after thinking back over his entire police career, he could not think of any potential suspects who stood out and would have hated him so much to murder his son as retribution. For the first 2 years after the murder, Gary Sr. was still forbidden from working on the investigation in an official capacity, but once the graffiti showed up on the patrol car, he was assigned to work the case. However, this decision was met with heavy resistance from the prosecutor's office and the department's major crimes unit, so Gary Sr. was taken off his son's case less than 2 months later. Gary Sr. claimed that the people working the case were very evasive and would often shut him out, possibly in fear of how he might react if they uncovered a promising lead. In spite of this, Gary Sr. still spent years investigating his son's murder in an unofficial capacity by passing out flyers and sending out public pleas for information. The case would air on Unsolved Mysteries in December of 1993, but the segment failed to drum up any significant leads which brought them closer to resolution. Gary Sr. eventually retired from the police force, but never gave up on trying to find answers, and was given material about the case to look through on his own time. Sometime in late 2015, Gary Sr. was going through some old audio tapes in his personal files in order to convert them to MP3 format when he came across a tape labeled Phone Calls. To his absolute shock, the tape contained a recording of the anonymous 911 call you heard at the beginning of this episode. The caller asked how he could collect a reward on himself for the murder of Gary Grant, and when the dispatcher tried to connect him to the detective bureau, the caller reiterated that this wasn't a prank and said, "You'll never be able to catch me," before hanging up. What was significant is that the exact date of this call was March 8, 1986, which would have been Gary's 10th birthday. Well, according to Gary Sr., even though the tapes had been given to him years ago, he did not recall ever having heard this recording before and did not recognize the caller's voice. But that wasn't all. The same tape also contained the recording of a second 911 call which took place on June 2, 1986. In that one, an anonymous male caller stated that he heard Gary's killer confess to the crime and that he told him he'd killed Gary because of his father. Well, even though this caller was never identified, he actually named a specific suspect. This man's name has never been publicly released, but he had been arrested on charges of sexual contact with a child younger than 5 and child endangerment before pleading guilty in 2013. Gary Sr. actually recognized the name of the suspect, as he had lived in his patrol area, but he did not recall ever having problems with this person prior to his son's murder. Anyway, this discovery put the case back into the spotlight, as the media began to cover it again, and the recording of the first 911 confession was released to the public, but the caller has still never been identified. During one of the recent articles about the case, a retired Atlantic County major crimes detective who worked the case maintained that he still believed Carl Boom Mason was responsible for the crime and that they had the right person all along. However, after 34 years, there are still no concrete answers about the identity of Gary Grant Jr.'s killer or the motive for his murder. So I guess you could say, the trail went cold. But before we continue, let's take a few minutes to share a word from our sponsors. This episode of The Trail Went Cold is brought to you by Zola, and we are very excited that they are now supporting the show. Zola is reinventing the wedding registry and planning process to make the happiest moment in couples' lives even happier. From engagement to wedding and decorating your first home, Zola has you covered. Zola Registry has everything you love about your favorite department store, as well as things like honeymoon funds, fitness classes, and wine subscriptions. There are over 500 brands and 50,000 gifts and experiences. It's free, fun, and easy to use for both couples and their guests. They have price matching, free shipping, personalization options, and group gifting. Zola also has a free suite of wedding planning tools, including a free wedding website where guests can seamlessly shop and get details on the registry in one convenient place. Zola's friendly customer service team will go above and beyond, whether that's helping pick out the perfect blender or walking a grandmother through a couple's registry. There's also tools for the host such as a customizable checklist and guest list manager. Join 300,000 couples who have used Zola. I gotta tell you, I've known my fair share of people who have gotten majorly stressed out at planning their wedding or engagement party, but if they had Zola at their disposal at that time, the experience definitely would have been less stressful and more enjoyable. And from my personal experience, even trying to pick out the perfect engagement or wedding gift can be stressful, but I found Zola's website to have an amazing selection of gifts, and it's so convenient and easy to navigate. So to sign up with Zola and receive a $50 credit towards your registry, visit zola.com/cold. ZOLA.com/cold. Terms and conditions apply. That's a $50 credit towards your registry by visiting ZOLA.com/cold. This episode of The Trail Went Cold is also brought to you by Aptiv, another sponsor whom we are very excited to have supporting the show. Aptiv produces audio-based workouts created by certified personal trainers available through a mobile app. Aptiv makes the highest quality training available to everyone with a carefully selected group of certified personal trainers that guide you through every workout. The trainers have a wide array of personalities, so you can even find the personal training styling that motivates you best. Plus, Aptiv's in-house music production team partners with every trainer to create music playlists that are perfectly timed to the intensity and pace of your workout. When you need that extra boost, the music keeps you going and motivated. When you're ready to slow things down, the intensity of the music dials down with you. Whenever or wherever you like to work out, at the gym, at home, outside, when you're traveling for business, Aptiv is ready to go along with you with their mobile app. It's like having a personal trainer in your pocket. Whether you're interested in running, strength training, indoor cycling, stair climbing, yoga, or even meditation, Aptiv trainers give you the guidance you need to be better at the types of exercises you love, delivered in a flexible audio format to make fitness a lasting part of your routine. Aptiv has classes for all fitness levels, from beginner to intermediate to advanced. And with more than 2,500 workouts available on the platform and over 30 new classes added each week, there's always a new workout to try. Or simply pick the type of guidance you are feeling up for that day, whether it's technical training, high energy coaching, or boot camp style intensity. One of the best features of Aptiv is the ability to search by difficulty, music genre, and duration, so you can find a workout you love every time. As you might have guessed, being a podcaster is not a job which lends itself to a lot of physical activity, as you spend the majority of your time plopped down in front of a computer or a microphone. So in order to keep myself in good shape, I was very grateful to receive a free trial with Aptiv. Instead of having to take the time to travel to a gym somewhere, it was very convenient to work out with Aptiv's mobile app, which provides a flexible audio workout format that allows me to work out just the way I like without even having to leave my own home. That certainly saves me a lot of much-needed time. Subscriptions start at $9.99 billed monthly, or $99.99 for an annual membership. For a limited time, new members get 50% off an annual membership, which is just $49.99 for the whole year of unlimited workouts. So to take advantage of this offer, visit aptiv.com/cold. That's aptiv.com/cold. Thank you, and enjoy the rest of our episode. So this is definitely one of the more heartbreaking cold cases we ever covered on this podcast, as the idea of a police officer feeling powerless to solve the murder of his very own son is incredibly tragic. However, it's also an incredibly frustrating case, because on the surface, it seems like it should be solvable. Generally, when a police officer is murdered, their department becomes extra motivated to catch whoever was responsible. So can you imagine how badly they'd want to solve the brutal murder of a fellow officer's 7-year-old child? And to their credit, it does seem like the Atlantic City PD went full boots on the ground right after Gary's body was discovered, as they were able to uncover a very promising suspect within hours and were able to charge him the very next morning. But the problem is that they were probably so driven to solve this case, not to mention under such incredible pressure, that they became very overzealous. I certainly don't blame them for looking at Boo Mason as a suspect, but the methods they used to obtain his confession were highly questionable, to say the least. And once it became apparent that they wouldn't be able to take him to trial without this confession, the investigation just seemed to ground to a dead halt. It's almost like they took the attitude, well, we know who did it, but just don't have the evidence to convict him, so that's that. And they didn't look as hard as they should have at possible alternate suspects. I can certainly understand Gary Grant Jr.'s frustration over not being able to investigate his son's murder and having to sit back and watch the authorities make very little progress. But at the same time, I can't fault them for not allowing Gary Sr. to work the case. No matter how cool and rational a person may seem, you can never predict how they might react if they had to question or arrest a suspect in the murder of their own child, especially if it was a very vulnerable suspect like Boo Mason. If a suspect was charged with a crime, and Gary Sr. was a part of the official investigation in any way, then I can imagine this would open up a lot of potential issues at trial. Now, before I start analyzing this case, I should provide some perspective and remind everyone that the world was much different when this crime took place. Some people might find it surprising that Mae Grant allowed her 7-year-old son to go outside and play in their neighborhood by himself that afternoon for several hours. Well, my only response to that is that this was 1984, and parents just felt a lot more safe about their children and had no fears about letting them play outside unsupervised, especially in a neighborhood which had probably never seen a horrific crime like this before. I was a kid during the 1980s, and I can attest to the fact that I went outside to play in my neighborhood without adult supervision all the time. It's just kind of a pet peeve of mine when I come across missing children's cases online from several decades ago, and commenters will criticize the parents for leaving their children unsupervised, but it's only because of cases like this that parents became more aware of these dangers. So I really don't think any blame should be placed on Gary's mother for what happened. Anyway, the last time May saw Gary alive, he told her he had a quote-unquote appointment with someone that afternoon, and the fact that Gary used that exact word has always raised a few eyebrows. Appointment is just not a word you'd expect a 7-year-old to use to describe a meetup with other children, which is why many people have speculated that Gary had a meeting set up with an adult that afternoon, and that's where he heard the word appointment. Since Gary wouldn't share any details about this appointment and told his mother it was a secret, this might sound like a strategy a pedophile might use, where they lure children to a meeting and tell the child to keep the whole thing a secret. However, Gary was not sexually assaulted or molested in any way, so there's never been any indication that this crime was sexually motivated. But there are signs that someone did lure Gary to a meeting of some sort and did not want him telling any adults. Now, here is an issue you'll often find on true crime shows in which they present key pieces of information in the reenactments, which you're not sure is accurate. During the Unsolved Mysteries segment, they show a reenactment where an actress portraying May goes looking for Gary at a friend's house, and two sisters tell her that Gary was there, but left at 4:30 to go home. While none of the official sources out there I could find confirm whether these girls actually said this, or if this is just nothing more than dialogue from a reenactment which is inaccurate, this is a key piece of information, because if Gary did actually leave their house at 4:30, then this means he was alive for at least 2 hours after his 2:30 appointment, which pokes a major hole in the theory that Gary was lured to a secret meeting by someone to murder him. I actually wonder if Gary's 2:30 appointment was with Boo Mason. Since May claimed that she told Gary he was not allowed to play with Boo, this might explain why Gary decided to keep the appointment a secret from her. If that's the case, then this might mean Gary met Boo at 2:30, and whatever paved the way to his murder was something which did not occur until 2 hours later. So now's a good time to talk about the prime suspect, Carl Boo Mason. I've covered nearly 100 cases on this podcast, and Boo is easily the most unlikely murder suspect featured in any of them. At the outset, even the investigators working this case had a hard time reconciling the possibility that this kid might be responsible. When the Unsolved Mysteries segment was produced in 1993, Boo was 21 years old at that time, and he actually agreed to be interviewed on camera. And when you see him speak, yes, it is really hard to picture him being the type of guy who would bludgeon a 7-year-old to death. It's interesting to read some of the original newspaper articles from the time Boo was charged with the murder, as they interview several kids from the neighborhood who do not believe Boo could have done it. In fact, some of these kids were Gary's own cousins. In their eyes, Boo was far too timid to ever harm anyone. I mentioned earlier that Gary's mother did not want him hanging around with Boo, but I'm not sure it's because she felt he was dangerous. Even if Boo himself was relatively harmless, he was 5 years older than Gary, hailed from what appeared to be a dysfunctional, low-class family, and Boo's older brother had recently gotten into trouble with the law. so I can see why May might not want Gary to associate with them. However, the reason Boo showed up on the radar in the first place was because he was caught in a pretty major lie, as he denied being with Gary on the day he went missing, even though multiple witnesses claimed they had seen them together. Of course, like I've said on this podcast many times before, eyewitnesses can be mistaken all the time, but these witnesses reported seeing Gary and Boo together only 2 days after the fact, so it still would have been fresh in their minds. In particular, there's no reason to believe that the two sisters who claimed Gary and Boo visited their house together that afternoon aren't telling the truth. Boo said that Gary was supposed to meet him that day and never showed up, but the facts just don't seem to support this. Now, while police certainly had good reason to suspect Boo, the court still had every right to toss out his confession. Regardless of Boo's guilt or innocence, you definitely have to question the ethics of bringing a 12-year-old kid with an IQ of 65 to the police station at midnight in order to interrogate him until morning without an attorney, while coercing him and his grandmother to waive their rights before he signed a confession to the crime. You can find hundreds, if not thousands, of wrongful conviction cases where someone with a low IQ or a mental disability spent years or decades in prison for a crime they didn't commit because they were coerced into making a false confession. It also happens to adults who don't have any sort of mental disability, so it's easy to see how it could happen to a 12-year-old boy, even if he didn't actually commit the murder. All that being said, regardless of the validity of Boo's confession, there are compelling arguments for both his innocence and guilt. Like I mentioned earlier, at least one investigator on this case is still convinced to this day that Boo was the killer, but Gary Grant Sr. seems to lean towards the idea that Boo did not actually commit the crime himself, but was there when it happened, and knows who did it. Now, Boo's original confession seemed to indicate that Gary's murder came about because the two of them got into a fight, and Gary threw a rock at him, so Boo responded by striking him in the head with a pipe. Even though Boo was believed to be this timid, harmless character who had never hurt a fly, I guess it's not completely implausible that in the heat of the moment, having a rock thrown at him could have set him off and prompted him to snap and violently attack Gary. But on the other hand, Boo was a very small guy, who was both shorter and lighter than Gary in spite of their 5-year age difference. I'm not going to go into graphic details, but the injuries to Gary's head were incredibly brutal and seemed to suggest that the attack was carried out by a much stronger and larger individual. There's some question about whether Boo would have been physically capable of inflicting these injuries. The biggest issue is the lack of physical evidence linking Boo to the murder scene. His fingerprints were not on the murder weapon, which ordinarily might not be such a big deal since anybody can just wipe their prints off a pipe, but there's some question about whether Boo would have had the intellectual capacity to even consider the possibility of fingerprints. Boo's defenders also don't find it believable that he would go to the trouble of covering up Gary's body with a rug. Given how easily frightened he was, Boo seemed like the type of guy who would immediately flee the scene in panic after fatally attacking someone. While tiny spots of blood were found on Boo's clothing, the graphic nature of Gary's injuries suggests that whoever killed him would have gotten more blood on them, and would Boo have had the wherewithal to do an almost completely thorough job of cleaning blood off himself and his clothing? I suppose Boo could have gotten someone else to clean up the evidence and cover for him, but his primary guardian was his grandmother, who allowed him to be interrogated by police, willingly signed a statement waiving his rights, and co-signed his confession, so I really doubt she had any knowledge about what happened. Of course, the other alternate theory is that Boo did not actually commit the crime, but witnessed it happen, which would explain his inconsistent statements and initial denials about seeing Gary that day. I don't put much stock in polygraph tests, but they seem to give off the impression that he was being truthful when he denied killing Gary, but untruthful when he denied being at the scene. The police seem to put a lot of stock into the fact that Boo mentioned choking Gary, a piece of information about the murder which no one else knew at the time, but Boo still could have known this by witnessing someone else choke Gary. However, the big question here is, if Boo could be so easily manipulated into falsely confessing to murder, would he be able to keep his mouth shut and cover for someone else? I guess if Boo witnessed Gary's murder, and the perpetrator said they'd kill him too if he told anybody what happened, then that could have frightened Boo so strongly that he kept his mouth shut. Then again, if the perpetrator had no qualms about bludgeoning a 7-year-old boy to death, Would they really be that hesitant about killing an eyewitness like Boo? I guess it's also possible that Boo could have seen the murder take place and ran away before the perpetrator could catch him, but he was so terrified by the experience that he couldn't bring himself to tell anyone what he saw. I previously made mention of Boo's older brother, who was arrested on robbery charges a few days before the murder. In a 2009 article about the case, Gary Grant Sr. pushed forward a theory that Boo's brother attempted to get Gary involved in a scheme in which he would use young children to break into homes for him. If Gary refused to go along with this scheme, he might have been killed for it, particularly if the perpetrator knew Gary's father was a police officer and could potentially cause trouble if Gary told him about it. Well, the confusing part here is that Boo's brother was arrested a few days beforehand, but I've never seen any clarification about whether or not he had been released by the time Gary was murdered. If Boo's brother committed the crime, and Boo himself witnessed it, and decided to remain silent, then that's a pretty logical explanation, but obviously, this theory doesn't work if Boo's brother was still in jail at that time. And if the rumors are true that the brother was recruiting kids to break into houses, then it seems like a really stupid idea to approach a kid whose father is a police officer. But without more information about Boo's brother, I can't really be certain how plausible this theory is. Of course, if you completely eliminate Boo from the equation, the big focus has to be the cryptic graffiti and anonymous 911 calls which took place 2 years later. It's quite interesting how all these events took place during 1 6-month period in 1986. It all started with the graffiti on the patrol car on January 4th, which referenced the upcoming 2-year anniversary of Gary's murder. It was this development which prompted the police chief to grant Gary Sr. permission to investigate his son's murder, though he wound up pulling him a short time later. It's worth noting that they actually published an article in the newspapers announcing that Gary Sr. had been assigned to the case, so I'm inclined to think it's no coincidence that the second cryptic message, which read, "Son of a pig officer," showed up on the sidewalk during the same time period. And then there's the anonymous 911 call from the person confessing to Gary's murder. Not only did it take place on Gary's birthday on March 8th, but it occurred only 1 week after another newspaper article had been published announcing that Gary Sr. had been reassigned and was no longer investigating the crime. For all we know, the graffiti and the phone call might have been done by the same person who wanted to torment Gary Sr. Of course, the fact that the sidewalk graffiti read, "Payback's an MF," made people think that Gary was murdered because of something his father had done during his police career. And as an aside, I've always found it very weird that they literally use the initials MF. They write graffiti which mocks the murder of a child, but they'll draw the line at using foul language? Anyway, Gary Sr. cannot think of any specific suspects from his police career who struck him as being angry enough to murder his son as revenge. But of course, just because Gary Sr. couldn't think of anybody does not mean he didn't cross paths with any criminals who were capable of committing this crime. For all we know, Gary Sr. could have arrested someone for a non-violent crime, not knowing that this person had violent tendencies in them, and were so vengeful about the incident that they decided to target their arresting officer's child. Hell, it's even possible that the killer was a relative or a friend of someone Gary Sr. arrested. Being a 10-year police veteran at that time, there are so many different ways Gary Sr. could have angered someone without even knowing it. Another alternate explanation is that the person or persons behind the graffiti and phone call had nothing to do with Gary's death, but still had a vendetta against his father. In other words, Gary Sr. could have arrested them for something in the past, and when they read about Gary Jr.'s murder in the papers, they thought it might be fun to taunt Gary Sr. about his child's death. Maybe it's just me, but when I listen to the anonymous caller's tone of voice when he asks if he can collect a reward on himself for Gary's murder, I kind of get the sense that he's trolling. So it's possible that the graffiti and the 911 call might have been nothing more than sick pranks. Now, the real frustrating thing about this 911 call is that Gary Sr. did not actually hear the recording until nearly 30 years later, and if he did listen to the recording before, he does not remember it. I can't imagine what a jolt it must have been to hear an anonymous person confessing to your son's murder. The whole situation sounds pretty strange, but the impression I get is that someone provided Gary Sr. with a bunch of material related to his son's case years after the fact, and he just never got around to listening to those audio tapes, until he decided to convert them to MP3 format. After all, audio cassettes are a pretty obsolete format. Given that the original investigators seemed to go out of their way to keep Gary Sr. in the dark about the case back in 1986, it's not implausible to me that he wouldn't have heard the recording of the call when it originally happened. For all we know, the police could have already investigated the call and determined it was not a credible lead. But even though Gary Sr. didn't recognize the caller's voice today, I can't help but wonder if things might have turned out differently if he was allowed to listen to it back in 1986, when his memories would have been fresher. However, even if that particular call is a hoax, the second 911 call, in which an anonymous male actually named a suspect who allegedly confessed to the crime, is fairly compelling. Once again, it's been 30 years, so for all we know, this lead may have been checked out at the time and deemed not to be credible. But the one piece of information that we do know about the suspect who was named is that he was arrested for sexual contact with a child younger than 5 and child endangerment. While Gary Sr. does not recall any personal issues with this guy, he definitely sounds like someone who is capable of harming children. So while he may not have had any issues with Gary Sr., he could have set his eyes on Gary Jr. Even though there were no signs of sexual assault with Gary, this could have been a situation where the murder took place before any sexual assault could occur. The perpetrator lures the boy to a secret meeting, makes advances towards him, but when Gary resists, things escalate out of control, and Gary is bludgeoned to death with a pipe. But this is only a theory, and since no other information about this suspect has been publicly released, I can't say for certain he's responsible. There are so many possible reasons for why this crime might have happened. Perhaps by pure chance, Gary happened to stumble upon something illegal or something he wasn't supposed to see and was killed for it. But overall, I still think that Boom Mason is the key to this whole thing. I do have my doubts that he actually killed Gary himself, but I have a feeling he was probably there to witness it happen. While it's hard to imagine Boo committing such a brutal crime, I cannot get past the fact that he initially lied to police about being with Gary on the afternoon he was killed. While I'm no expert on Boo's mental state, part of me wonders if witnessing an event like Gary's murder could have been so traumatic for him that he completely blocked it out. Maybe he was there, but legitimately does not remember it, so when police questioned him, he believed he was telling the truth when he claimed he hadn't seen Gary that day. I don't know, I just have a hard time reconciling this whole thing. If Boo witnessed a stranger murder Gary, why would he lie about it? But at the same time, if he witnessed someone murder Gary and lied to protect them, would he really be capable of concealing such a big secret for this long? When new articles about the case were published in late 2015, the media attempted to contact Boo for comment, but they were unable to reach him, so I have no idea what he's doing today. If his original interrogation had been handled differently, and he'd not been coerced into giving such a questionable confession, then perhaps this could have been solved immediately. As it is, it's a terrible tragedy for Gary's entire family, and I can't imagine how painful this experience must have been for Gary Grant Sr. It must be an incredibly powerless situation to be a police officer who is legally forbidden from investigating the murder of your own son, especially when you're unhappy with the way the investigation is being handled and believe you can do it better. But this is a case which could potentially be solved if the right person came forward with information. If the anonymous 911 caller was actually Gary's killer, maybe someone out there will recognize his voice from the recording. Maybe the second anonymous caller will come forward and provide more substantial information to build a case against the suspect he claims is responsible. So if you have any information about the murder of Gary Grant Jr., please contact the Atlantic County Major Crimes Unit at 609-909-7666. That's 609-909-7666. But if you just have your own thoughts about what happened, feel free to leave me a comment or send me an email at robin.warder@icloud.com. That's robin.warder@icloud.com. Just wanted to give another shout out to my supporters at the Unsolved Mysteries message board at the Sitcoms Online Forum and the Unresolved Mysteries subreddit. I need to provide a big thanks to Miguel Foote, who edits and assembles this podcast together for me, and Vince Nitro, who composes our eerie music score. Before we bring things to a close, I would like to inform you that at the moment, we currently have a Facebook poll going on where you can vote on which case you'd like us to feature on our 2-year anniversary episode coming up in February. I've selected 10 of my most highly requested cases which have been suggested by multiple listeners. You'll find the poll pinned to the top of the Trail Went Cold's Facebook page, and it officially closes on Friday, January the 19th at midnight. So if you'd like to cast your vote, be sure to visit our page. And as you probably heard, The Trail Went Cold will be appearing on Podcast Row at this year's edition of CrimeCon, which is being held at the Gaylord Opryland Hotel in Nashville from May 4th to the 6th. This will be your chance to meet me and several other great true crime podcasters. If you're planning to purchase tickets to the event and haven't done so already, you can visit crimecon.com and receive a 10% discount by entering the promo code TTWC. That's TTWC. If you haven't already, you can like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or leave us a rating or review on iTunes, Stitcher, or Google Play Music. We also have a Facebook discussion group, so if you feel like discussing the podcast or the cases we feature with myself and your fellow listeners, feel free to join, and I'll approve your entry into the group ASAP. Like I mentioned earlier, we also have a donate button on our website, so if you're feeling generous and want to express your appreciation for all the hard work we put into this podcast, we'd be extremely grateful. So have yourself a good week, and join me next Wednesday for a brand new episode of The Trail Went Cold. We'll be right back.